Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut. I'm here in the studio with the AJC's lead political writer, Jim Galloway. You read him on Thursdays and Sundays in the paper. And, of course, he oversees the Political Insider blog. This is Wednesday. You've got a deadline to get a column out. What are you writing for tomorrow?
I want to ponder over what Nathan Deal is going to say on Monday when they take the wraps off that statue of MLK on the state capitol grounds.
Interesting times to be writing about statues.
Putting statues up instead of tearing them down.
That's exactly right. We'll look forward to that, Jim. And in Macon, at our Macon bureau, is Charles Richardson of the Macon Telegraph. Charles, we're so glad that you are back on the show. And appreciate your joining us.
Good afternoon. It's good to be in an air-conditioned office. Ours has been out for the last couple of days.
Oh, my gosh. You're kidding.
It's been brutal.
Have the presses ground to a halt, or do you still get that paper out, Charles?
Still get the paper out, no matter what.
It just feels like the
1950s. Yes.
What are you working on right now, Charles? What's the next thing we're going to read from you in the Telegraph?
Well, you know, there's this guy in Washington in radio they would call it the hit parade, and every day there's a new hit parade, so you sort of have to pick something and stick with it, but tomorrow it could change.
Yeah, you know,
so
I'm
being very flexible.
Well, you know, we go through that with Political Rewind. We think we put together a show and think we know what we're going to talk about. And I now say to panelists a day ahead of time, who knows what's going to happen overnight that will change everything.
Yeah, well, now, Wednesdays are pretty stable. It's the Fridays that you really have to worry. That's when the dump comes.
Yes. Or the tweets.
Yeah. Let me just tell our listeners that Senator Jeff Flake is, we're standing by. He's going to be joining us momentarily, and when he does, when he walks into he's going to be joining us by phone, so when he walks into the location where he's going to be calling into us, we will get him on immediately. But while we wait for him, Jim, let's talk about, this is the timing to have Senator Flake on is pretty appropriate. Last night in Phoenix, without mentioning him by name and yet kidding about the fact he wasn't mentioning him by name, the president went after both John McCain and Jeff Flake.
Right, and then this morning we had one of our morning tweets from the president where he went off on Flake by name. So it's out there.
All right. So I'm told that Senator Flake is now with us. Senator, thanks so much for joining us for Political Rewind. We're delighted to have you with us. Joining me for our conversation is Jim Galloway, who's the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and Charles Richardson, columnist for the Macon Telegraph. So the state is well represented in our conversation with you. I know we have limited time with you today, so let's get right to it. Your book is Conscience of a Conservative. The fuller title includes A Rejection of Destructive Politics and a Return to Principle. And it's a book in which you lay out your concerns about the Republican Party moving from its traditional conservative philosophy to more of a populist philosophy, which you believe is kind of like a sugar high. And also, you have been, from the very beginning, you were a never-Trumper during the primaries and were one of the few who remained one after he became the nominee. And here's the quote that I think is a good starting point. You say, "We pretended that the emperor wasn't naked. Even worse, we checked our critical faculties at the door and pretended that the emperor was making sense." Help us understand what that means to you. Flesh that out just a little bit for us.
Well, thanks. The title of the book is very much an homage to Barry Goldwater.
He wrote
the original Conscience of a Conservative back when he felt that the party had been compromised by the New Deal, that conservatives and the Republican Party. And at this time, I think that it's in different forces, obviously. It's populism, nativism, isolationism, anti-immigration fervor, and I think that we risk being a minority party forever if we continue down that path. So I do think that, it's called populism for a reason. It's popular. You can win an election. I don't dispute that. But this mishmash of policy we have now is not a governing philosophy, and that's my concern going ahead.
To what extent do you want your book to be a clarion call out for your fellow members, Republicans in the U.S. Senate, on the Hill for that matter, to follow your lead to resist Trump and populism? And to what extent do you think you're going to remain a lone wolf out there, isolated from a party that hasn't seemed yet to be willing to pull away in the way that you have?
No, I do think that my colleagues are speaking out on some of the issues that matter. On trade, for example, the president talked in the campaign about ripping up NAFTA. That has since moved to renegotiation, hopefully in a way that simply modernizes it and we move ahead. I know a number of my colleagues want to go there. In terms of foreign policy, I think the president, with his speech the other day, realized that some of the positions he'd taken in the campaign, as he mentioned, his initial instincts, he couldn't go forward with. So there is room for him to change, and I hope my colleagues will push a change on things like on immigration, for example. We as Republicans have traditionally been welcoming of legal immigration and have been standing up for the rule of law, but we also have to make sure we have a rational policy for those who are here illegally now, for the Dreamers, for example. We just can't continue down the path of being an anti-immigrant party. That's a recipe for the minority.
Now, Senator, there's a report.
This
out
is this, Jim Galloway, Senator.
There's a report out this morning that there's movement in the White House to offer up security for the Dream Kids in return for a larger immigration reform attempt. Is that are you hearing the same thing? Is that kosher?
I haven't heard that this morning. We know that we have to have a solution for the Dreamers. We all said that what President Obama did was not constitutional, and so we needed to deal with that issue in a constitutional way. That gives us an opportunity when that comes to the House and to the Senate to actually broaden it and do more comprehensive immigration reform. I hope that's what we do.
Let me get you Charles Richardson of Macon Telegraph in here. Charles?
Senator, last night the president said that he would shut the government down rather if he didn't get funding for his wall. I realize that Arizona, being on the right there on the border, is faced with some immigration challenges that other states don't face, having been born on myself. But what do you think about that? And is that just hyperbole, or do you take his threat seriously?
I certainly hope we don't have a government shutdown. That never ends well, never saves money. Republicans usually come out on the losing end of that thing. With regard to the wall and border security, I'm glad the president went to Yuma yesterday. And he, in some of his comments afterwards, I think he is coming to a better place on this. A singular 2,000-mile wall has never made sense. In fact, if we've done anything over the past couple of years, it's taken up the wall that is there and put it in its place a fence. And he mentioned that. You need something that you can see through when people are throwing rocks on the other side. That's in terms of border fencing. You just need to look back to the so-called Gang of Eight bill, the bipartisan bill that I was part of. We provided in there for 700 miles of fencing and said that anybody who is here illegally wishing to adjust their status couldn't do so until that was in place. And so, that was tough border security, but it doesn't envision a singular wall.
Yeah. Senator Jim Galloway here again. You are fortunate. You are talking to three gentlemen here who remember Newt Gingrich and GOPAC and the courses that he held in here in Georgia on how to speak to voters and what words to use. rather inflammatory words. And you do mention that in your book. But my question, there's a saying that goes, that everybody knows, you know, fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. You talk about leaders willing to mislead the public, but at what point do we start talking about people who are willing or even eager to be misled?
Oh, I don't know. I think here in Arizona, people will in the end come out in the right place. If we, as leaders, as elected officials, it's our responsibility to use facts and not to try to mislead the voters. I think that, you don't want any politician to ever blame the voters for something. I certainly don't.
No, I understand that. That's hard.
We've got to lead. And one point I make in the book is that, you know, there's nothing easier than for a politician to, for example, point to a shuttered factory and blame a free trade agreement. You know, that's the easiest scapegoat. When that is almost always not the case, it's modernization, automation that has changed the dynamic in terms of our manufacturing. And if we want to grow our economy, obviously it needs more free trade agreements, not fewer. But that's tough for politicians because that's, you know, it takes longer than 30 seconds to do that. To explain that. But it's our responsibility to actually not just talk about how you can win an election, but how you can govern. And the problem is, as I mentioned in the book, once we get off that sugar high of populism, then it's particularly ugly. And I was in the majority in, you know, 2001 to 2006 in the House. We had it in the Senate as well, and we had the White House. And we lost it all. Because I don't think we comported ourselves very well as Republicans and conservatives.
Hey, Senator, since you are talking to, this is Gingrich country here in the state of Georgia, you talk in the book about the trend of gamesmanship rather than statesmanship. And you in some ways attribute that to the rise of Newt Gingrich way back in 1994, the Contract to America, his success in winning the House for Republicans. You say that he's a character with extraordinary talents for self-promotion. Are you telling us that Newt Gingrich is really a character who's part of the problem and not going to be part of the solution? Is there no love lost between you and Gingrich?
Well, let me tell you, I was running a think tank during the 90s in Arizona. Mike Pence was running a think tank, conservative think tank in Indiana during that time. And all of us, boy, we would look at the House and that Contract of America and think, man, this is where it's at. In fact, Mike and I commented at one point that we felt like Minutemen called to the battlefront in 2001, only to be told that the revolution was over. Go home now. And it was sobering because I talk about in the book that I remember well Dick Armey, who ultimately became majority leader, and Bill Archer, chairman of the Republican, you know, the Ways and Means Committee, going around the country having like a concert tour to debate the flat tax versus the consumption tax.
Right.
And
right.
That's back when the party was about ideas. And we lost that. And we, you know, during 2001 to 2006, we became the party of holding on to levers of power as a way to keep the majority rather than persuasion and ideas. And I mentioned in there, it seemed like the Republican leadership at the time, which was Congressman Hastert and Congressman DeLay, seemed to instinctively, if you could pass legislation with a good bipartisan majority or pass it with a bare partisan majority, they seemed to opt for the latter in a way that you could use that to, you know, use that as a cudgel to beat your opponents in the next election.
Yeah.
And that's something that may be good for the party in the short term, but it's horrible for the country in the long term.
Charles, we're going to run out of time for Senator Flake in a minute. I'm going to give you a chance to ask him another question.
Just how do you move people away from or back toward talking about real ideas and away from, quite frankly, fear? Because it seems that fear is what has the winning game right now.
Yeah. Well, it is. I mean, it's we've become a party of anger, and ascribing the worst motives to your opponents. I remember speaking to Mike Pence, he always used to say, I'm a conservative, I'm just not in a bad mood about it. And it seems like today, what typifies or the stereotype of a Republican now is somebody who's angry, who's out there driving wedges rather than, pushing ideas. And it's maybe a tough road back because the way that the 24-hour media and social media certainly seems to advantage and give incentive to those who yell the loudest.
Senator, let me ask you one. I'm sorry, you want to finish that thought? I apologize.
Go ahead.
One last question, because I really want to be mindful of your time. I mean, your ears had to be burning again last night. The president didn't mention you by name, but he certainly referred to you. He has informally endorsed a primary opponent against you, and yet every time you're asked the question about how you feel about that, you seem remarkably sanguine about that prospect. Are you putting on the best front you possibly can, or can you in fact win re-election in Arizona given the dynamics of the conservative base in that state?
Yes, I can win.
Well, there you go.
I can't control what the president does, but I can run my own campaign. And, I have a pretty important day job. But the campaign will come, and we have a good structure set up and a lot of support out there. And Arizona tends to value those who stand on principle. We tend to elect independent-minded senators, and that's what... That's what I'm banking on.
Do you think the president's going to get a primary opponent in 2020 the way things are headed right now? And then we'll let you go.
I don't know. I don't know. I think that certainly depends on him. I think he could govern in a way that he wouldn't. But I think that the direction he's headed right now, just kind of drilling down on the base rather than trying to expand the base, I think he's inviting one.
Senator, as we let you go, of course, a lot of us who have covered him over the years, I've covered John McCain through two big presidential campaigns. Can you tell us how he's doing?
He is one tough bird. And, I'd say this is a tough diagnosis, but an even tougher man. And I tell you, he's been tromping around the state and meeting with groups and just doing his job as well as going through his treatments. And he's had his first 3 weeks of chemo. I guess the doctors will see now how that's done and then move forward based on what they've learned. But I can tell you one thing, there's nobody tougher. Nobody tougher.
Senator Jeff Flake, I thank you so much for spending time with us and for sharing your thoughts with our network, our NPR network across the state of Georgia. I know people here are interested in what you had to say today and also will be interested in reading Conscience of a Conservative. There are a few of us who actually remember the original Conscience of a Conservative.
That's great. Well, thanks for talking about the book.
Yes.
I appreciate that.
Take care. So we'll have a link on our website to the book so everybody can get information
Wonderful.
About it. Thanks, Senator Flake.
Thank you. Okay.
Let's take a quick break right now and come back, and we'll kind of reassess what we heard Senator Flake tell us.
GPB's fall fund drive begins soon, and with federal funding in question and program costs on the rise, your support now is that much more important. Please go to gpb.org to donate, and you'll also enter to win a St. Simons Island getaway for two, including a three-night oceanfront stay at the King and Prince Beach and Golf Resort. Relax on the beach, enjoy scrumptious meals, or play golf. Your support will also encourage others to join you in supporting GPB during the drive. That's gpb.org, and thanks.
Back on Political Rewind, Jim Galloway of the AJC is here. Charles Richardson of the Macon Telegraph joins me as well. Gentlemen, why don't we spend a couple minutes talking about what Jeff Flake had to say? And let me throw out a comment to both of you. I've said, I keep harping on this, that the president's record so far. His conduct in office seems to me increasingly to be pointing towards the possibility he'll have primary opposition in 2020. I didn't hear Jeff Flake dissuade us from that notion when we asked him that question.
I think Flake is a big possibility. Of course, there was a New York Times article yesterday on where Trump was headed, and you had John Kasich really laying him out there.
Yes, Charles, you have. Well, John Kasich hasn't stopped running. You know, he really hasn't. So Flake is up there, Kasich is up there, and the friends that the president is making in the Senate right now, any number of people could run against him.
So, but you heard what the problem here is. I mean, it's hard to go after Trump without going after the Trump voter.
Exactly. That's exactly right. But I think there's a, expand on that, except I think the other problem you hear here is Flake is very critical of the president. He's critical of this move towards populism, but he's supportive of almost every point on the Trump agenda. That's where I think there's some real problems.
Right, but you're trying to tell the populace, and these are real voters for Jeff Flake. Are you trying to tell voters that they've been bamboozled?
And would they believe you?
And not everybody wants to be told that.
Yeah, interesting.
Right.
So, Charles, Jim, we talked very briefly. The president not long ago tweeted out his informal endorsement of an opponent who looks like she's stepping forward to take on Flake in the Republican primary out there. Kelly Ward, she ran against McCain last time around.
Right. She called for his resignation.
Yeah.
Right. Already. Wasn't that sweet?
Yeah.
Right.
As soon as the announcement came that he had brain cancer, she stepped up and said, give me the job. He should resign. She's a little bit out there on the fringes. She was all about something called chemtrails, which are those contrails that you see that a jet leaves behind in the sky. She was part of a group of people who believe those contain chemicals that are being used in some way to have a negative impact on the American people. She got very into that last year.
Fluoridation of the stratosphere?
Yeah, fluoridation. Let's listen. And of course, Mitch McConnell is furious. We have learned in the New York Times reporting about the fact that Trump seems to be encouraging primary opponents to incumbent Republicans. So McConnell, the super PAC that supports McConnell, has put out an ad bashing Kelly Ward. We won't play the whole thing for you because it's over a minute long. But let's hear some of that at least.
1 year ago, Arizona Republicans rejected chemtrail Kelly Ward. Remember why? Ward wasted your tax dollars for a town hall on chemtrail conspiracy theories and sponsoring chemtrail legislation.
I'm open. I introduce legislation for constituents all the time.
About another chemtrail town hall?
I'd do it again. Of course I would do it again.
Chemtrail Kelly's got her head in the clouds with crazy ideas. She bizarrely blamed John McCain for ISIS.
John McCain is directly responsible for the rise of ISIS.
That's just a little bit of that ad, Charles.
Well, you know, who knows what chemicals are being released in the air, but when I first read about the controversy, my mind immediately went back to a Rod Serling episode of The Twilight Zone.
Mine didn't, Charles. You know, my head went to Agenda 21, that meeting in the state capitol that Chip Rogers put on.
Yes,
zoning was part of an international conspiracy.
Yes, that's even better. That's close to home.
And it is amusing. But the fact that a super PAC that backs Mitch McConnell has already, this is a web ad, of course, so it doesn't cost a lot of money, but the fact that they are already in the game and take seriously the threat to an incumbent senator in a state that could very easily vote him out of office despite his display of confidence says an awful lot about the impact of Donald Trump on his, allegedly his, Republican Party.
If I could game it out a little bit, I mean, they're, you know, they have to defeat this chemtrail Kim.
Kelly, or whatever.
Okay, Kelly. Okay, all right. Should she get the nomination, that pretty much means that there's a really good chance that that seat would go Democratic. And Mitch McConnell would be pretty much out of a job at that point. But the problem here is that Mitch McConnell's standing is just so low nationwide right now. And you see the same thing happening in Alabama right now, where Luther Strange is actually struggling.
The incumbent who has gotten the president's backing, but the president couldn't put him over the top in the Senate race, the special election for Jeff Sessions' seat, without a runoff. And he's facing
Roy Moore, the former state Supreme Court Chief Justice.
Twice removed from his seat on the Supreme Court for illegal conduct, right, Charles?
Yeah, and you've got other issues in Nevada, and you've got this open warfare going on. It's sort of the war by proxy. You know, you've got Mitch McConnell and Trump that are having words, very serious words, according to the New York Times, and you've got a majority leader that is supposedly carrying water, the president's water, that has to be carried very quickly to the debt ceiling, to tax cuts, to all this, and you're really ticking him off.
Yeah.
And I'm just not sure where that's going to lead, and we'll find out in a short month's time.
Will, for those of you out there who have not read the New York Times piece, it's pretty brutal. It suggests not only that they're not getting along, basically the article suggests that McConnell and Trump are virtually at war with one another. They've had at least one phone conversation in which profanities were exchanged. And the Times, of course, points out that September is going to be an incredibly busy month up there. They've got they want to get a tax cut done. They've got reconciliation. They've got a debt ceiling that they've got to agree to raise, or else the country goes into default. The president still wants to do health care, but that isn't going to happen.
No, but you saw him shift a little bit last night when he threatened to shutdown of the federal government if he doesn't get his money for his wall on the southern border.
That's right. All right, go ahead, Charles.
No, I was just going to say that, you know, while we'd love to think of our senators and congressmen as fine, upstanding people, they're going to do what's right for the country, and they will. But relationships are how things work and how things get done. And if you don't have some relationships, you have somebody walking down to the well of the Senate, as John McCain did, and do a thumbs down. And that thumbs down was also because of, okay, Mr. President, here you go.
Yeah.
That's what that was about. He can say differently, but he had a smile on his face when he did it.
All right, Charles, you and I are going to continue this conversation. Jim Galloway has got to leave us early today.
We don't need to say why.
It's
business.
It's business that I hope we will be able to discuss on Friday.
Very soon.
Political Rewind, Mr. Galloway.
I'm all ears, Mr. Galloway.
So we'll let Jim take his leave of us. And Charles, you and I will continue. And we're going to keep talking, and Jim will make his way out of the studio. Jim, thank you. We'll see you on Friday's show at
3 o'clock.
Okay, great. Charles, let's talk about last night in Phoenix. You know, to put it in context, as you well know, and everybody does really, Monday night the president went on national television, didn't get a great audience. He got about 17 million viewers, I think, on the three networks. There were reports that the last time when President Obama spoke about Afghanistan policy, there were 40 million people watching. So we'll see how that ends up as the ratings keep being coming in. But Monday night he played the role of presidential with a teleprompter speech, and most people thought on Tuesday night he would become the Donald Trump of the campaign rallies. I didn't. I really thought that he was going to try to stay on message. I thought that the people like John Kelly, his chief of staff, were beginning to have an impact on the way he comports himself.
Bill.
I did, Charles.
Bill.
I was wrong,
Bill.
Clearly.
Bill.
Yes.
It's like the two faces of Eve, the two faces of Trump. When he's on teleprompter, he's not the greatest speech giver in the world, but at least he stays on message. But he is a pretty good speech maker, whether you like what his words or not, when he's off script. He knows how to excite a crowd. He takes the energy from the crowd, and then no telling where he's going to go. But he shows you in his speech last night who is in control of his message, and that's the President of the United States.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you say that. Last Friday, Eric Tannenblatt was with us for Political Rewind, and it was the day that we learned that Steve Bannon was being pushed out. And Eric made that. Eric, a longtime mainstream Republican, worked with both Bushes, worked with Mitt Romney closely. Eric made that point. He said, if you think that things are going to change with Steve Bannon gone, you're wrong. And as you say, Charles, last night we saw that. Let's play some sound, and then you and I will talk about it, because there was an awful lot last night that is worth, I think, unpacking. One of the things that seemed to anger the president most, and that he basically devoted the first 30 minutes of a 75-minute rally talk to, was the fact that he thinks he had that the media really, really misrepresented him in terms of his remarks about Charlottesville, that he did, in fact, condemn the bigotry and hatred of the white supremacists at that rally. But here's what we're going to do. We're going to play back-to-back, first the sound of the president in his first public remarks right after the Charlottesville episode. Riot, I think, isn't too strong a word.
No, and that's then, Saturday afternoon.
That's right. And then we're going to go into what he said last night, and we'll talk about that.
We're closely following the terrible events unfolding in Charlottesville, Virginia. We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. On many sides. So here's what I said really fast. Here's what I said on Saturday. We're closely following the terrible events unfolding in Charlottesville, Virginia. This is me speaking. We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence. That's me speaking on Saturday, right after the event.
So, Charles, it's notable that, of course, he left out in his quoting himself from Saturday the on many sides.
On many sides.
What does you that know, say to you?
I'm amazed at not just his blindness or deafness, that you can so easily go back and check his words. It's not someone on his staff, and they probably did, say, here's what you said, Mr. President, and he's chosen to edit himself. So he knows exactly what he says. He knows that. So you have to consciously do that. And he knows what created the uproar. But, you know, with this president, quite frankly, that's kind of old hat.
Yeah, I think that's right. Let's listen to another. This is a very short soundbite, but I think it says something about a certain kind of nonchalance or lack of seriousness that he displayed last night in terms of how he responded to Charlottesville. Just listen to this.
I hit him with neo-Nazi. I hit him with everything. I got the white supremacists, the neo-Nazi. I got them all in there. Let's see. Yeah, KKK, we have KKK. I got them all. So they're having a hard time. So what did they say, right? It should have been sooner. He's a racist.
So he's talking, of course, about the fake news media. Charles, the president last night did at one point in the rally say he condemns hatred and bigotry of the neo-Nazis, the KKK, other white extremists. But when he speaks with such casual when he makes such casual remarks about those groups as he just did, it really there's a dissonance there.
There's a wink, wink, nod, nod. There's I've been going back and doing a little research on some things that presidents have said in the past on when they had to face some very difficult issues. And I remember when there was turmoil in the South and Lyndon Johnson came on the air and he used the phrase, and we shall overcome. I won't go through the whole speech, but he had a recognition that we had to do something as a nation. I remember when Bobby Kennedy, in announcing the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, and the words that he said on television to announce the slaying of the civil rights leader, but also talking about what we had to do as a nation.
Yeah.
And thus, that's just a couple of instances.
I have to tell you, I'm really glad you mentioned both of those instances. I have to say, for me, if you go back in and, you know, search it on YouTube to the LBJ speech in front of a joint session of Congress talking about the need for civil rights legislation, when he closed his speech with those words of Dr. King, we shall overcome. It was one of the most moving moments, I think, in contemporary American presidential history.
It'll send chills up your spine, knowing the scene, knowing what was going on in the country. But he took that opportunity, as presidents can, to say, this is what we need to do as a nation. Now, you only get one chance to do that. And that chance for President Trump was Saturday afternoon. And he blew it. He did come back. Give him all the credit in the world. He did come back 2 days later and address it again. But then the next day, he blows it again and basically takes back everything he said.
All right, let me do this. I need to get in a break, Charles. When we come back, we're going to just another couple minutes on the Trump rally, because he attacked the media. And as much as frequently and with the vitriol that he's used in the past in talking about the media, I think last night he really, really dug deep. And I think we should talk about the implications of it. But let's take a quick break. This is Political Rewind. We'll be back.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Mark Pitkavage, a senior researcher at the Anti-Defamation League, about America's militia movement, what they stand for, how they've evolved since the election of Donald Trump, and why some showed up bearing arms and wearing camouflage at Charlottesville. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Charles Richardson of the Macon Telegraph joins me in our Macon Bureau. Hey, Charles, I do have to say, it was interesting to hear the Fresh Air spot. I've told people on this show before, I spent 7 years as the Southern Director of the Anti-Defamation League, which is one of the country's most prominent civil rights organizations. And Mark Pitkavage, who is the expert at ADL on extremist groups, I worked with a lot. And I really think that people who get a chance to hear that Fresh Air will get a lot out of it. Mark is a genuine, there's nobody who knows more about extremist groups than he does. So I was glad that promo ran on our show.
Yeah.
Hey, Charles, let's talk just briefly about the president's latest attack. The president, of course, last night accused the media of being behind. It's the media's fault that the country is divided in as extreme a way as it is right now. And I do think he went further in some of his remarks about the media than he has in other instances.
These are really, really dishonest people, and they're bad people. And I really think they don't like our country. I really believe that. The only people giving a platform to these hate groups is the media itself and the fake news. These are sick people. You would think they'd want to make our country great again, and I honestly believe they don't.
All right, Charles. He's talking about us.
Yeah, he's talking about us, but I think the problem that we've seen with this particular president is that it's only news to him if it's patting him on the back and if it's his vision of what's right and what's wrong. He forgets that our job is, quite frankly, to try to tell the truth. And as we've seen under instance after instance through his own words, that he forgets to do that sometimes. And it's our job to point that out when that happens. They can say that we're picking on him, that he can say it's fake news, but these are his words. He's on videotape. He's on audio tape. He said one thing on one day, and he said exactly the opposite on the next day.
Or he edits
out one thing that he said the day before. That's our job, is to report the news and what he says.
Okay,
if
you don't mind, let me just, here's where I think there's this interesting disconnect. And I think maybe in a way you can argue with me on this, please do. You know, when President Trump said on Saturday, there's violence on many sides, here's what I think is the reality of this, and the reason he's so angry at the media for reporting that he wasn't clear in condemning white bigotry. This is a man who has no understanding of history. What Trump saw in the streets of Charlottesville Saturday afternoon, he was correct to say was a violent confrontation of certainly the white supremacists with particularly the Antifa or Antifa anarchists. They were clashing violently. That's what Trump saw, and that's what I think he was talking about when he talked about it on many sides. But what this forgets is that he has no historical knowledge of the white supremacist Klan Nazi movement to ground what his understanding of all this is. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense. He also didn't see the videotape of the night before at the University of Virginia, where they're carrying torches through the campus and they're hollering about hatred for Jews, hatred for blacks, hatred for just about everybody. And that sort of sets up confrontation. And you have people that are saying, you're not going to say that on our campus. You're not going to say that on our city. And also, I'm not sure he knew the process that the city of Charlottesville had gone through before they decided to remove the statue of General Lee.
Right.
Now, and this is an imperfect analogy, but you and your wife decide that you're going to rearrange the furniture at your house, and somebody comes knocking on your house and say, you can't do that. Well, you know, and then the police come and they say, well, you know, both you're all at fault, even though half of them don't live here.
Yeah.
You know? So,
you know, okay, the only reason we revisit this is because the president opened the wound again last night. It'd be nice if we could lay this to rest. And for the rest of this show, let's do that. Let's move on. But I do think we have to point out that unfortunately last night, despite the fact that he seemed to try to say he condemns right-wing extremists, it just didn't end up being the message that resonated through the rally. Hey, let's talk. You want to talk about Hillary Clinton for a few minutes?
Yeah. I'm on the lead-in on the beginning of the show. You say she's got a new book out.
Yeah, her new book is about to be published. And MSNBC got an exclusive to play clips from her audiobook, which she, as many authors do, read herself. And there are a couple of really interesting comments that I think are worth listening to. First, she answers a question that many people have asked her about. How do you feel about what happened?
Writing this wasn't easy. Every day that I was a candidate for president, I knew that millions of people were counting on me, and I couldn't bear the idea of letting them down. But I did. I couldn't get the job done, and I'll have to live with that for the rest of my life.
And Charles, we can only imagine that's exactly right.
Yeah, it is exactly right. But, you know, there is a moment in time for everybody, and her moment in time for that particular office just never arrived. And, you know, you were never a shoe-in. Twice, who had heard of the little-known senator from Illinois, Barack Obama, when he announced his candidacy for presidency? She was supposed to be the anointed one then. Didn't happen.
Yeah.
She was supposed to walk into the White House mostly unopposed, and then somebody by the name of Donald Trump gets the nomination on the other side, and he walks into the White House.
Yeah.
It just wasn't meant to be.
I want to listen to a longer excerpt from the book, again, thanks to MSNBC. Well, many people remember that in the second debate, there was an unusual physical dance that went on. It really was a one-sided dance. Candidate Trump seemed to be crowding from behind into Clinton throughout. He was standing right behind her. When she moved, he moved with her. And this took place shortly after the Access Hollywood tape came out, in which Trump bragged about his ability to have his way with women. And I think it's worth it. As I said, it's a little bit longer, but let's listen to Hillary Clinton talking about that.
This is not okay, I thought. It was the second presidential debate, and Donald Trump was looming behind me. 2 days before, the world heard him brag about groping women. Now we were on a small stage, and no matter where I walked, he followed me closely, staring at me, making faces. It was incredibly uncomfortable. He was literally breathing down my neck. My skin crawled. It was one of those moments where you wish you could hit pause and ask everyone watching, well, what would you do? Do you stay calm, keep smiling, and carry on as if he weren't repeatedly invading your space? Or do you turn, look him in the eye, and say loudly and clearly, back up, you creep. Get away from me. I know you love to intimidate women, but you can't intimidate me, so back up. I chose option A. I kept my cool, aided by a lifetime of dealing with difficult men trying to throw me off. I did, however, grip the microphone extra hard. I wonder, though, whether I should have chosen option B. It certainly would have been better TV. Maybe I have overlearned the lesson of staying calm, biting my tongue, digging my fingernails into a clenched fist, smiling all the while, determined to present a composed face to the world.
So I have to tell you, Charles, listening to that and recalling the debate, I think about the fact, the famous saying, politics ain't beanbag. I'm not sure that if what appeared to be an intentional decision on Trump's part to stand right behind her to ruffle her feathers, you know, I'm thinking that, that Hillary Clinton overthinks that. I mean, that seems to me to be a tactic that had some impact and worked, and I'm not on Hillary Clinton's side on this one, to be honest. Tactics are tactics.
Yeah, and you know, you have to you have to rise above those kind
right
of
exactly
tactics.
And she says she had an opportunity to stare him down and say, get away from me, you creep, and she didn't.
Exactly, and she could have. I think one of the things that I my opinion changed a little bit about Hillary Clinton was during the hearings on Benghazi, when she finally had had enough of them, of the people that were in, had her in the Inquisition, where she got a little ticked off, and she fired back at some of the congressmen, and she actually showed some spunk. And if she had turned around at that time with Trump and showed some spunk, she might have gotten a few more votes. Who knows? But she had that opportunity. She didn't take it. Then, you know, what Trump did worked.
Yeah, there's no question that her book, which is coming up soon, I think it's called What Happened, is going to be filled with stories that political journalists and other junkies are going to be chewing over for a long time to come, Charles. We'll watch and see how it unfolds. We're running out of time, but while I've got you from Macon, are you guys down there dealing with Confederate memorials or symbol issues right now in the aftermath of Charlottesville, or is everything sanguine in Macon, Georgia?
Oh, it's just perfect on a day that it's 93 or 4 degrees. Yeah. Yes, we are dealing with some of that. There is a Confederate soldier memorial right in downtown Macon at the intersection of Cotton Avenue and 2nd Street. It's been there. It's been at its present location since the 1950s. It was a little bit further east on 2nd Street before it was moved there. There is former mayor is trying to get some black ministers riled up to think about moving it. As you know, there's a state law that says you can't move it. My opinion is quite, I really don't care. I think
why don't you care? Tell us why you don't care. Because you're a well-respected and veteran African-American journalist in your community. So your thoughts on this have a special meaning.
This is what I wrote in a column last week. This is the white community's issue. They own it. They put it up. They can take it down. This is for their sake to decide if they want that kind of image to the world for themselves. They can solve it overnight if they want to, and that's up to them. Those statues mean nothing to me, one way or the other. You can leave them up there too, but it says a lot about the people that put them up there in the first place and when they put them up there.
And by that, you mean these were not statues that were erected immediately in the latter days of the war, right after
exactly.
the war. These were, in fact, many people believe, put up much later as an effort to subdue the African-American populations, to intimidate African-American populations in cities in which they were erected.
Exactly. And you know, we can have different versions of the Lost Cause, and I encourage my readers, go back and read the Articles of Secession if you want to find out the causes or the reasons the Southern states left the Union. Read it in your ancestors' own words, and that way you'll know for sure.
All right. Charles, thank you for giving us a good subject to give some thought to as we close out today's show. One of the reasons I wanted to address that is on Friday's Political Rewind at 3 o'clock, we're going to have a fuller, more robust conversation about where things stand in communities across Georgia in terms of the new efforts, once again, to figure out what to do about symbols of the Confederacy. So, Charles, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. My pleasure.
Okay. Try to stay cool and stay in air conditioning.
I'm going to sit in here for the rest of the day.
All right. Good. Good. That's almost it for us today. Let me just say that, as I said, we will be back with Political Rewind Friday at 3. In the meantime, tomorrow on Two-Way Street, which comes your way at 2 o'clock, there's a show that I really would love for you to all listen to. We talk with Chris Feeley. If you're a Prairie Home Companion fan who went through that transition a year ago from Garrison Keillor retiring to Chris Feeley taking over as host of Prairie Home Companion, you'll be interested in his thoughts on how that went for him as he gets set for his second season. But I think even more important, Chris Feeley is a musical prodigy, a genius. He's the only mandolin player who's ever won a MacArthur Genius Grant. And his playing with the Punch Brothers elevates bluegrass music in a way that is astonishing to listen to. We're going to talk about that, hear some of his music tomorrow on Two-Way Street at 2. So I hope you join us for that. That's it. We're out of time. Jenny Ament, Olivia Rheingold, Tyler Morris, thanks for your work in the booth today. See you again tomorrow for Two-Way Street, Friday for Rewind.